I don't seem to recall some of the ship that I traveled on. One of them was American Legion, President Polk. I don't seem to remember others. There's a couple of times or so that we was instructed to transmit some messages from the aboard ship to the land. I think it was around Guadalcanal and also around Saipan. And some of the colonels that I remember, Colonel Shoup at that time, as I remember him. I served with him on Guadalcanal in Saipan. In fact, him and General Matt Smith, they used to call him. Those two used to be in the command post, particularly in Saipan. And I used to carry a message from his command post out in the field. And several times there, I transmitted a message with some of the Navajos, coat topper.
So they were just messengers?
Yes.
They were messengers as well as a coat topper. Do you remember any particular time when things were pretty hot and you were asked to get a message across to whoever was receiving on the other end?
It seemed to me somewhere in Tarawa, our colonel instructed us that we get on the radio so he can watch us. And he gave us some message that we transmitted somewhere out on the another island. We don't know where it was, but it seemed to me some of these code talkers was in the 4th Marine Division that we were talking to them, but we didn't even see them. I know they were Navajos, but I didn't.
Did
you get
any messages back, or was
it
just
a message? Yeah, no, we just sent the message.
So that's what you didn't know. Your messages were so secret that you didn't even tell them to your buddy, did you?
No.
This was
confidential.
Very confidential. Now, was there any time, well, I asked this question of Mr. Sandoval today and a couple others, about the use of utilization of religion, the Navajo religion. Did you depend on your religion during the stress and strain of a battle, or did you have a ceremony before you left and an enemy way when you came back? I know Mr. Judge Wilson said that they did for him, an enemy way coming back, and as Mr. Sandoval said today, as a counselor, he thought that it really had a tremendous help. It was a tremendous help. Mental health.
Psychologically.
Yes.
It is effective. My story, I'll have to tell it a little differently. I was a young man. I was just around 18. And I just took it for granted that it was good to join the Marines. And they just gave me a short notice, and I didn't even have time to go back to my parents, my father and my mother. I was working down here in Fort DuPont Hospital. And all of a sudden, I made up my mind I would join. And the next day, I was all fixed up for physical examination, application, and so forth. And they hauled us to Fort Winnegate as Indian school there the following day, and we were sworn in. That same evening we left. I didn't even have time to go back. All I did is I wrote a letter to my mother and my father. But during the course of the battle, particularly, I was in the midst of Tarawa battle. I was in the third wave. First wave, as I learned, that you don't have a chance, hardly anybody lives. You're just very lucky to make it, or you don't. That's right. Second is a little better. Third, you have a good chance in the third wave. I was in the third wave in the Tarawa. On the Guadalcanal, we landed on there when the 1st Marine Division had secured at least half of the island, on Guadalcanal, when we got on there. So they were just kind of keeping us in the back. Once in a while, they were make us go to the front, just kind of get involved in sending a message over there. They keep us in the front line for maybe a day, half a day, and then they bring us back. I guess this was mainly for the security reason. They don't want anything to happen to us because it was quite important, and they don't want for us to be exposed to the main battle all the time unless it was necessary. This is the way it went. As I remember, I just prayed to myself the way my mother and my father taught me. They told me to pray to Heavenly Being and also to your Mother Earth, things of that nature. I was exposed a little bit to the Catholic religion before I went into the Marines, but I did not take it very seriously because I was a young man at that time. But all through the battle, something told me that I should pray for myself, and I just prayed, I think that something up above will protect me. Many, many, many times. But I did not know any Indian chant or something like that, but when I came back from war, surprisingly, my mother told me that, son, did you know that since you left, till the day you came back, almost every morning at dawn, she said she never hardly missed it. She went out to a little hill, a sacred little hill, and she prayed there using a sacred corn pollen, that nothing would happen to me, that I would come back with my whole physical being, that I would have still a good mind. She told me that she just prayed and prayed all she could, all the way through, all the time that I was overseas. And she told me that maybe this is the reason why you all came back in one piece. I came back in one piece, but I had a hell of a time on malaria. Yes, I got contacted with malaria on water canal. I think there must have been about 6,000 Marines on there. Most of them got it within 4 months, and the last 16 people, I was among them to get the malaria. And some of the colonels and the general asked me asked us, there was several Navajo like me, they were, how was you raised that you're so tough that you didn't even take the quinine, or you didn't even take pills and all that, but you almost lived through it. You was among the last ones to get it. I says, I don't know. I just had a tough living, when I was a young boy. After I came back, I remember specifically, I first hit the island in San Francisco, and then they moved me up to some kind of a rehabilitation center, which was located in Camisole, Oregon. I stayed there 3 weeks, and then they shipped me down to Oakland, California, to a naval hospital, and then they shipped me back. From there, they gave me a month's leave. And malaria got the best of me, that I was nothing but bones at the time. So nevertheless, I came back to Gallup, and my father met me there in Gallup. He's dead now. And he says, the minute that I stepped off the bus in Gallup, New Mexico, he met me. And he said, son, I'm glad you came back alive. And he said, I don't want you to go anywhere. I don't want you to go to town. I don't want you to run around trying to have fun. I know what you're up to. I said, I want you to go home with me right now. I have something waiting. I have a medicine man waiting for you. That's what he told me. He says, I said, okay. So then I came back with him, cleared out the chimney. He hired a truck. In fact, there was a few trucks in those days when I came back from war. At my home, they hired a medicine man for me. Anyway, had to see over me and fix me up. One thing I've noticed that I would not forget to this day is when we had the scene over me, my parents were so thankful that I was back that they went ahead and killed a little 9 months fat goat, real young goat, tender. They skinned it and they wanted to feed me a nice red barbecue rib, but when I tasted it, it didn't have no taste to me. I just couldn't eat it. I don't know why. It seemed to me that when you are young, when you're away into a foreign country, exposed to malaria and battle and different conditions, situation, wind, air, and everything, it seemed to me certain food does not seem to go with your stomach anymore. For a while. And so, yes, I learned that.
Sorry, Yolanda.
We can remember some of the details.
Remember the story about what? How he got back. We can remember that.
Yeah, now, yes, how you got, I think that's so funny.
Let me pick up his story. When the boys were telling him what Ricardo.
Oh, yeah.
Then go follow him.
Yeah.
Do you mind repeating that now? We'll have it on tape.
Yeah.
In group.
Yeah, these boys were telling me, hey, Chief, where are you going? So I told them, I said, well, I joined the reconnaissance, the 5th Reconnaissance. They said, oh, are you crazy? I said, I don't know. I said, maybe I was crazy. I said, what in the world is reconnaissance? And they start telling me. Boy, you'll never come back. Nobody will ever come back. Nobody comes back when you join that outfit. How in the world did you get in there? I said, well, I was forced to. And I told them, you know, my story about what I did, you know. I said, that was the only way they told me that I get a transfer, so that's how I'm getting transferred. Oh boy, we just feel sorry for you, you don't know. They said, wasn't there any other outfit that you could volunteer for? And I said, no, that was the only one. And you know that, yeah, so that night, boy, I just couldn't sleep. Oh, I just kept thinking about it. What in the world did I get into, you know? And I just couldn't go to sleep. And I stayed awake all night. Next morning, then we went to breakfast, you know. Went to breakfast. And finally, one of these big power wagons came over around about 9:30. And they picked me up. I was the only one. They picked me up.
You were the only one.
Yeah. The others were going different. To gunnery school and some other places.
They were volunteers, all were volunteers.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So I was the only one going to 5th Reconnaissance.
This wasn't Camp Pendleton.
This was, I left Camp Pendleton, then they were transferring me to San Clemente. That's where that prison farm used to be.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They revised that to.
They took you to the old prison farm.
Right. So when I went over there, why? Here there was all different uniforms they were wearing, you know. And I went over there. And I was a stranger, but when I went in there, why there were some Navajos. I didn't know them. Never knew them.
Those are the ones you named for me a little while ago.
Yes, that's how I got to know them.
And they were coat-toppers.
They were coat-toppers.
I see, and this is where you got back into the coat-toppers.
Right. And then...
how did it happen that these other coat-toppers were sent to the old farm?
Well, they're all... See, when they formed this hack, good morning.
Good morning.
When they formed,
yes, please do.
When they formed the, you know, whenever division is formed, and right away that's where Johnson signs these people out.
Yes.
You know, he says, well, these are ready to go. He signs them out to these different divisions, so that's what he did. I guess he signed these boys out there already, and they were there.
And they were ready to go overseas, were they?
Going in training, because it was just a newly organized reconnaissance, 5th Reconnaissance, just organized. I guess they were just there 2 weeks before I got there. And they really hadn't really started the operation because they needed more men, more volunteers to come in. So So that's how I, when I come in there, and then I saw these devils, and they were all laying there, you know. And, you know, where I came from here, you have to stand in line for, to eat. They ring that big bell, or what was it? Or whistle blows, yeah, it's our time. And then everybody runs out there, and everybody forms a line. And when I got over here, why, boy, it was 1 o'clock, and boy, I was getting hungry. These guys just laying down. And finally, I had to say, well, when do you guys eat anyway? I said, oh, are you hungry? Oh, you just go over there and tell them what you want. I said, you do? And of course, I didn't quite believe it. Yeah, I said, just like if you go downtown to a cafe, you just go in there and Navy cooks are there and there, and you just tell them what you want. You know, and they laugh, just like pork chops or steak. Really? I said, you know, I just couldn't believe it. So when they mentioned that pork chop, I said, well, that sounds good. So one of the boys went with me. Well, I'm hungry too, I'll go. So we went in, sure enough, they had a counter. You went counter clear around, you know. And you just go out and sit up there, and they come up to you. They had a little cardboard like that and had a menu on it. Sure enough, there was steak and the pork chops and all that.
It couldn't be the army of
Marie.
Peanut butter jelly.
No. And I couldn't believe it. And then right away, these Navy boys, you know, right away knew I was new, right away, because I guess most of them ordered different things, and I was the only one to come to pork chop. And finally they said, did you just come today? And I said, yes. Oh, you're not. He says, oh, you're another one of those general's pets, huh? And I didn't know it, and I guess that's what they call all these reconnaissance people, general's pet, because, you know, they get anything.
Because their job is so hard.
Right.
That's right. That's correct.
And I didn't know that either. Oh, my.
So when you were finally in service, that you were sent to Iwo Jima then.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And in your reconnaissance work, did you use the code quite a lot?
Yes, we did.
Had you learned the code sufficiently when you were with Johnson before? Or did you have
no, not too good. I wasn't too good because I was teaching them mostly. But what I did was, you know, after evenings, yeah, when I had nothing to do, these boys had their list, you know, and they were studying them. And I'd tell them, let me look at that. And then, you know, and I used to just get hold and I'd read it, you know.
Sort of did a self.
Yeah, right.
You had been teaching Morse code and that sort of thing.
Right, Morse code.
Other than the novel.
Mm-hmm. So, but I was just studying that on the side, you know.
Then you said that you went to Hawaii was this after the Iwo Jima?
No, we were after we did our training there in, this one was 43. Well, early part of, February, that's when we went. January or February, we landed in Hawaii. So then we trained there again in Hawaii now, and it's up to, it's August. 44 is when we went over.
Men remember the exact date of
yeah.
All
yeah, time. Yeah, it's August. Here's the reason why. Look, I tell you why I remember it so well is because on August 12, 44, we left the States. And it was August 14th, 45, when the Japanese surrendered. That's why I just never forget it. Yeah, I never could forget that. And so we went to went to Hawaii on the big island, Hilo. That's where all the whole regiment of this 5th Division were there, the 27th, the 28th regiments, all that. They were all in one unit there, this island. And I guess that's when they decided, we got to pick somebody up. We got to pick somebody up so these code talkers can get together, group them together every month, and to tell them what changes has been made on coding, you know, and what we have to do. And then finally here, this captain came to me and he said, you was picked from our outfit. Now you got to make arrangements. Now we'll leave this up to you. You make your own arrangement, but you gotta send letter memos to all these regiments and all the code talkers to come to a certain place. Now we'll find out where it will be. We'll get the place and then they'll come all together, and then you can talk
to them.
Good morning.
Then you can explain what changes has made. So if you want another day, why? If you need another day, why? We can do that. No, it's on. So, if you need 2 days, why, you just let us know and we'll make that arrangement. 2 days. He told me, but he said, To get up to date current information, we'll set the date. We'll find out because the headquarters is in Oahu, Hawaii. It's about 200 miles, and so you'll have to fly up there either 2 or 3 days ahead of time and get all your information. So that was all arranged for me every month before we had this meeting.
So that's the time you became an instructor again.
You're right.
By that choice.
Yes. So then they used to fly me up there, up to Hawaii. And I stay maybe 2 days, then come back again.
How long did you stay on that assignment?
I stayed up there until, we were there in August, September, October. I think we started in September, October, November, December, 4 months, and January is when we start sailing out. Mm-hmm. We didn't know where we were going.
And you had groups coming ever so often during that period?
Well, it's the same group, the same boys, the same from different
islands.
They came every month.
So you were just rotating?
Right.
Refreshing. Did you go to any?
The way we started it off, it didn't work too good. And then the boys themselves suggested, they came to me and they said, this don't work out good because we're always on maneuver. The day you set the meeting, why, we're always on maneuver. We can't get in. We miss out. You know, some of them missed out. They finally made a suggestion. They said, why don't you? Is there a way that we can be all congregated in one place? Because we need more rehearsing and all that. We need to practice more on our code to be really effective. But the way we're doing it, go back and then we're out in maneuvers again and we're not doing too much of it. So we like to come to one place and have our own course. You can be teaching us, and we'll do our own. So I went back and I told my captain, I said, here's the way the boys want it. I said, they go out on the loose. They want to know if they could congregate in one place, live there, just be right there, and then have classes every day. And he was really reasonable. He was really interested anyway. He says, yeah, he says, if they think that's the best way, let's go for it. I'll find out. I'll go to the headquarters and ask them if it's possible. If that's possible, then we'll pick out a place. So he went. Oh, it took about a week, and finally it was okay. Then we all had to move in one area, and they gave us tents. So we were segregated again right there. And then we started having these classes. That lasted for about 4 months.
Then you would have in a group at a time, and then leave, and then another group. How long would a group stay?
4 months. They stayed all together.
The whole
we stayed
group stay a group
four months.
Well, you gave them a very thorough.
Right, right. Then they got so that they were real
sharp.
Accurate, sharp. Yeah.
Then your plan was to have another group 4 months. But the
no.
War ended.
No, this was just only the 5th Division.
That was just for the
That's
5th
all.
Division.
Right. And then when we moved up, they didn't tell us where we were going, but then we just moved up.
Then you went into combat.
Yeah, we went to Marshall Islands, went to Guam, went to Saipan, Tinian. Finally, we unloaded at Tinian. And, Tinian, and then we stayed there about 2 weeks, and then all at once, my outfit, my group, reconnaissance, finally said, okay, tomorrow night is our night. We got to go to Iwo Jima. That was 3 days before the attack.
Now, that's when your story came in, that attack. You
no, not this one. No, this is, this one, we went up the whole. We got on battleship and took off. Mm-hmm. We went to Iwo Jima, and I was in with the headquarters. So we were back about 5 miles. 5 miles, and then these other boys. Some of them went halfway in between the islands, and then other boys made the attack. I mean, they. Out around the island, well, all they do is reconnaissance. They went all around the island, about 12, never came back.
Where was that?
Iwo Jima, 3 days before they attacked.
That was your first combat, wasn't it?
Yeah, observation. That was our first observation. No, we weren't going in. All we were spotting out a place where the wave, the invasion will take place. That's all we were looking for.
Just feelers.
Yeah, feelers, yeah. And 12 never came back. 12 fellas never came back.
What was the total number of fellas that went in,
I think it was 50.
About 50, 12 lost out of
50. 12 was lost.
And then... about the in the graveyard.
Oh, at a graveyard. After this, then they make this final invasion. The final invasion, and then it.
And that's when you had your experience.
They said, okay, your reconnaissance, since you went over there the first 3 days, so you guys will be in the third wave. So we watched from the deck, you know. And first wave.
It's a suicide wave, isn't it?
They couldn't make it. They couldn't make it. Iwo Jima. The first wave couldn't make it. This guy that talks over the microphone from the ship said, turn back, turn back. Boy, they were just hitting them just right and left. Oh, yeah. They just didn't have no chance. And so they had to come back. And he says, now, get back, and then we're going to call up the bombers again. They're going to come back. So we had to wait for the bombers, and they came. They bomb again. Then the second wave, he told the second wave to be ready. Because as soon as the bombers, when they go, you take off. Well, they tried again. The same thing happened. They couldn't. And I noticed really watching them. And then right away I thought in my mind, I'm going to tell my cox, because we were in the third one. When the second one had to pull back, then I knew we were going to be the first one then. So then right away I figured out, I said, I'm going to tell my cox to zigzag. Because none of those guys zigzagged. They all went straight. So I didn't know how to tell him, because right away we used to call him Stormy. He was a lieutenant. He called him Stormy. And see, I was a corporal, so right away he says, Corporal Baxter, he says, I want you to get right in the bow, right, stand over there, and then get all these men lined up right in the Higgins boats. So he got me way over there, right at the end, where the gate goes down, you know. So then, man, I had to put him down. Yeah. Real time.
That's on the 50-yard line, isn't it?
Yeah. And so then I got them all set down. And then these guys, I was standing up like this, you know. Every once in a while, they'd shoot over, you know. They were sitting down. You know, I was scared like everything, but...
Oh, no, not why
but,
would you be scared?
But these fellas... But these fellas, you know, I had them kneeling down. They're all, you know, kneeling down. And they said, hey, Chief, aren't you scared? And I said, no, I'm not scared. I guess I didn't show it, but inside of me, I'm real scared. Boy, right.
As far as I can tell, because I've always been very sensitive to names and titles and situations, but the men I found from the Southwest, the coach, they were affectionately called Chief. They just called him as a Chief. How about you have one, Carl? Because I'm hosting this table. This is my day for hosting this table. So get yourself.
Go ahead, Carl.
get a steak.
As we finally got across that airfield there at Iwo Jima, the third night, and the Japanese were way up high on the hill, and they just shoot at us. And we just, but when we got at the foot of that hill, there was a little knoll that we wanted to get over that night, and so it was all planned. And they said tonight at midnight. Because right at midnight, or just close to midnight, is when they start shooting that first flare. And they said, just as soon as they shoot that first flare, now everybody be ready at that time and look right straight ahead of you and see where to go. Now we're going to advance 200 yards. And we couldn't see this graveyard. See, we didn't know there was a graveyard over that knoll, you know. And those tombstones are about 4 and 5 feet, some are 6 feet high. We didn't know it, you know, and so here comes that flare, you know. And boy, we looked straight ahead, and the three of us now, which we were together, and the other three was at the other end of the line there, and we were on this side. There was Ambrose Howard and Ambrose Howard and Ray Smith. He's the councilman, Ray Smith.
Howard Smith. Mm.
And finally, when that fire came in, we sure took off. Well, we started crawling, you know. And we had sticks and a piece of pipe to see the
traps,
you know. There wasn't any traps in front of us. We just kept going. And then we time ourselves, and well, we got there in about 15 minutes, 15 or 20 minutes. And boy, you'd be surprised. When you're scared, you can really do things in a hurry, you know. Excuse him. He wants. Anyway, we are bigger than the table. At least three of us could sit down in. You know. That's all cinders, you know, it's cinders, you know, it's not, it was soft, you know, and boy, we just went right down, you know, and then here we sat down like this, you know, and I guess it was just about ready for the flare to come on, and then that flare, they shoot it over the enemy line, and boy, we were just looking above the ground like that, and all of us hear that flare coming, and then that flare start wiggling like this, and I guess the shadow of these tombstones about 4 or 5 feet, they were moving. And we thought they were right here. Jeff's coming after. Boy, we start hearing, and they start yelling, "Hey, hey, stop it! You're giving our position away." Boy, then we quit. We didn't know what meant
that.
And
then you said you had dug this foxhole in the grave.
Yeah, it was in the grave.
What? Parents were probably haunting, you know.
Didn't tell them what happened.
That's why when this guy yelled out, boy, we didn't know what was going on. And you see, there were sand crabs in there, and we told Smith. Mm-hmm. We told him to sleep first, and he got down. We said we'll watch and we'll take turns. He went down, and I haven't slept for 3 days. I didn't even sleep a wink. You know, we were still going. We haven't even slept yet. And so we told him to try and sleep. So he got down there, and he got off. So, no, he says, I already watched him sleep. He says, I don't want to sleep. So they told me, and I said, oh, no, not me. I just can't sleep. I know I can't sleep. And so we told Ambrose, why don't you try it? Why don't you try it?
What's his name?
Ambrose Howard.
Ambrose Howard.
Yeah. Why don't you try it? I said, he says, all right, I'll get down and try it. And the boy, he got down there and he just settled down. He took his helmet off, you know, and just by that time that sand crab come along and with those pinchers came right on his neck and he yelled. Boy, we didn't know what in the world. And he was yelling, we were looking around, you know. And we didn't know what was wrong. What's wrong with him? What's wrong with him? He said, help, help. And we didn't know where he was. You know. We know he was down here, but we thought maybe he jumped out and got caught. You know. And finally, we knew then the flare was coming on in a few minutes. And so he kept yelling, help, help. Finally, the flare came. Then we look over there, and boy, here he was. He was way down like that, and the thing was right on him like that. You know? Yeah. They
come from the back.
Yeah, he come from the back. Big one is kind of 30 pinch.
So, unless you go into details, you know, descriptive and describe, but just one word say patriotic. Just like John Wayne or Flag, you know, guys
work.
It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yet, some of these hours, most of the hours, we've got to observe that. It always asks me, gee, patriot? Well, what's the, you know, the patriot that comes in? It's hard to explain. It's a matter of, well, in the Second War, it was a matter of fighting for our country at that time, but not now. See, the Vietnam War is entirely different.
I know.
They're fighting for, I don't know what. But at that time, we were being attacked, you know, as close as Pearl Harbor. And that was too close to our land. As
and
well
of course
as
the Japs had said they would take our government.
They were headed this way.
I mean, they were really, so it was.
So,
it was a perilous period.
Over here, among the Navajos, the patriotic, none of that world was ever patriotic. It's a word, something that is, there's no such a word in that.
You're just fighting for your land, was the,
well, even,
is that the philosophy the boys had?
Even that, you know, well, the closer I could get is if somebody's trying to take something away from you, you have to fight that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way now we would explain.
Carl, instead of the word patriotic or for the country, or does the word, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, Dena? Does that cover that?
No. Dena is
the people?
A group of people. That's all. A group. That's used real common among the Athabascan in Canada, right along the border. There's a lot of Athabascan names. Different tribes, but they talk the same. See, Athabascan is a language. And everybody talks that language right now. Well, Dena. Really common word up north.
Meaning the people.
It means the group.
The group.
Yeah. Even white people could be the next. You know,
I see.
That's the Navajo.
Do you use it here in the Navajos?
In the Navajos, you go.
I remember it in Martin Link's book, A Century of Progress. He talks first about the dinner.
Somebody came up and said that the Navajos were calling themselves the people. You know.
And you said
that's
that
right.
Yesterday, and I'm glad
that
you brought that.
Now, that's why
up.
I brought it up.
Yeah. And now I read something out of Life magazine or something that said the and but yesterday you said that is giving a wrong impression. It's a wrong impression. Because it makes it look as if you are the only group or superior to everybody, but that is not the meaning.
That's right. Just like
the people mean the people of the tribe.
Well, here's a good joke about it. The Navajo, you know, they were signaled here, and one of the ladies said, how many, see, go over there and see if there's anybody over there. They were cooking, so a little bird ran over there. And they had known there's people over there. So he said, this lady said, how many of them? Well, she went back over there again, and Nezna means death, died in Navajo, and it also means 10. There were 10 people over there. That's what she meant to say. So she came back. And Neznala, they died, you know, sound like as well. They died. It's just a joke.
It is, but your language is so peculiar.
Who is the co-chairman?
Yeah, I know.
He is
in charge of veteran affairs.
Yes, this young fellow from Vietnam War.
Evans. I was thinking about Draper.
No, Ted Evans.
Yeah. His
well,
assistant.
Anyway,
you know his name?
He's just almost acting as our host.
He's being so
the big
nice.
Big tall fellow? Oh, wait a minute. That's not the
yeah,
Ted Evans who is the co-chairman.
Yes. He's a little bit. Cute little girl, you know, and his wife was there.
Yeah.
She works over here, I think.
We want to know the name of the young man who is his age because he's the last one.
Oh, yeah,
Leslie Nelson.
Leslie.
Oh, Leslie's the last name.
Well, anyway, she
theater and come on our frequency. Every once in a while, they say something.
Oh, really?
Were yeah. Yeah, we get it. They catch our frequency, and they'll say something to us.
Teddy Draper told me.
You know, and then so one night they really start shelling us, you know, and then we could hear them say, "Deskoi, Kuchikoi," or something like that, you know. And then finally, I told I don't know who it was, Raymond Smith or somebody. I said, "Why don't you go in there and just say?" Kuchikoi deskai. So he went over there and he really blasted. He said, Kuchikoi deskai, Kuchikoi. And pretty soon they come back. And then he went back, you know, after they quit. He said, Kuchikoi deskai.
What does this mean?
And then for you, you know.
Does it mean anything?
Kuchiko means to go this way.
Yeah. Oh.
But they say Kuchikoi. It's the same word, but it's only Kuchikoi. So he go back and say Kuchikoi, deskai, Kuchikoi, you know. Deskai probably meant where, because I guess they know where the signal is coming from, because they knew they could spot our signal where it was coming from, and when we said Kuchikoi, then they thought it was on this on this side and. And boy, they were really shelling on our left side. There was nobody there, see? And then finally they come back and they say something and